We'll start with these. A couple of chairs still here. Come in. Let's make it a circle. One more. We need another chair, another questions, but as I say, if anyone has anything they want to add to whatever answer I give, I think it would be nice if we share our answers. The first question that I've been asked is, who is an aspirant? And I think it's a very good question because it again calls on us to consider just what we mean. If we should call ourselves aspirants, I use the term aspirant, but some may use aspirant, but of course the very simple answer I suppose is that it's one who aspires, but aspires to what? In the theosophical context, of course, the aspirant is one who is seeking to find the spiritual path, to tread the path, as we call it. That is to say, he aspires to remove from his nature all of those aspects that are concerned only with the personal self in order that he can be of service, greater service to humanity. And so I suppose in that sense, within the context of the theosophical work, we are speaking of that individual who aspires to be of ever greater service, to lend his hands to those few strong hands who hold back the powers of karma, the powers of darkness, from gaining further inroads into human affairs. That, I would think, is really what we have in mind when we speak of that. The two little volumes that were collected by the secretary of Mr. Sri Ram, Elith Neisanger, of Sri Ram's, some of his statements, they're very terse, they're statements taken from his writings, from talks that he gave. Elith Neisanger was a very competent secretary, took down everything in shorthand, and she then compiled from his writings these two little books, which are wonderful for meditative purposes, Thoughts for Aspirants, Series 1, Series 2. And I think that as one even opens any of the chapters, any of the pages in those two little works, and meditates on one or another of the statements, you come to feel, what is that aspirant? What are you aspiring towards? Not for anything for the personal self, but always for the benefit of humanity. Anyone want to add anything of how they feel this? You want to come up here, I think, right there. It's easier. I know.
I only want to add a little what I get into my mind out of this book of Sri Ram.
The beginning is not all right, but go into the light and stay in the shadowless light. Mm-hmm. Shadowless light. I think it's such a wonderful expression. So it's, then one feels that there's quite another dimension.
Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful expression, the shadowless light. Yes. Anyone else have anything they want to add to this?
Only question.
What is
all
the questions has to be on
walk in front, that's fine.
What is then the difference between the aspirant and the disciple?
Ah, that's a good question, yes. What is the difference between the aspirant and the disciple? Again, if one looks at it from the technical point of view, the disciple is one who has definitely set feet upon the path. The aspirant is one who is aspiring towards this, I think. From one point of view, there probably is no difference. That is, we are all learners. We are all at school. We are disciples in that sense. Disciples not of a particular teacher, but of a teaching, of a wisdom tradition. So in the sense of disciples, I think we are followers of a tradition. But technically, it is that one has definitely begun to tread the path. Often the term disciple has been used for the term chela, which is the one who has been accepted as a pupil by one of the great teachers of humanity. To aspire, I think all of us are more in that category, if I may put it that way. We can't judge where another person stands. We have no right to judge. And we certainly cannot judge where another stands. So I think even the disciple is an aspirant.
I'm wondering, since several days now, whether you can be a disciple at the same time of on different paths. Let us say, at the same time, a disciple of Chökyam Trungpa Rinpoche, Inayat Khan, and Daniel van Egmond. And maybe at the same time on the theosophical path. I'm wondering whether that's possible. You didn't understand me?
Yes, I understand you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I always liked the statement that Clara Codd once made to me many, many years ago. Clara was a very wise person, a very beautiful person. And Clara said, "Joy, on the occult path, you do not mix your drinks." Now, we can study all of these. We can certainly read the teachings of many different teachers. But to truly be on the path, disciple, there is the choice that has to be made. This is the way, and you don't mix your drinks. And I think it's a very good statement, and one has to be very careful.
There's a difficulty, I think, when you say you have to give up everything for the good of all. That implies that you have, through attention, awareness, have discovered and have laid open all the secret corners of the personality. I think there's a danger that, as most of the people who strive for enlightenment, that they give up the personality too quickly. And that opens the possibility of failure, where you were talking about, mm-hmm. that failure is, of course, only human, and it's not a sin to fail. But it's like the Christian church that had, for centuries, the ideal of the celibate, mm-hmm. Which didn't work out. All sorts of wrongness came out of that. Mm-hmm. So perhaps that's also a thing we have to think about, and be aware whether we are prepared completely to do it, or whether we have we stand with two legs in two different worlds and like to keep it that way.
As I think I said in one of my talks, to give up the personality, you have to have a personality to give up. Which means there has to be a center that is ready to make a commitment. And that's what it is. It is a commitment. Obviously, we still have our flaws. And who is to say whether we will fail or not? The prospect of something dangerous does not often keep one from engaging in the risk anyway. And the possibility of failure does not keep everyone from making the effort. Try. So it is to try. The next question that yes, Theo, sorry.
My father has had a saying about making faults and so on. He said, no effort is lost ever.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is very true. A voice of the silence says every failure is a success. And this is true. I think we find that when you fail, in one respect you pick yourself up, you've learned something, and it is in that sense a success, and you go on and meet the next situation, perhaps a little wiser. So it is. And indeed, as I say, that's what the voice of the silence points out. Every failure is a success. And so we learn from it. If we really learn, if we're really willing to learn. Yes, thank you, Ted. The next question, what is a false guru and how can we recognize him? It seems to me that I used a moment ago in connection with disciple, and I was thinking of the Christian usage of the term. When you say follower, for example, that a guru demands, a false guru in my view, demands following, demands that you follow without thinking very often. I think there are several other characteristics to me that indicate a kind of falsity to the individual. First of all, the emphasis on money. If you pay sufficient amount of money, that then you are assured of liberation or assured of some status, and you're given some degree, and very often it's in proportion to how much money you can give. I think another criterion, very definitely, is always whether the emphasis is on the personal self, the enlargement of that egoic center, the person that promises that you as an individual, are going to become greater, stronger, you're going to have certain rewards, as it were. And the emphasis is always on the personal self, the growth of the personal ego. All that is promised is for the personal self. To me, those are the chief criteria. The money charged, the emphasis, is it on the personal self? And also, does it mean that you have to surrender your thinking to the individual? No independent thought. And it's a wonderful statement by H.P.B. You know that the theosophist is the independent thinker, thinks for himself. It examines the ideas. I remember some years ago, in fact, it was when I was still living at India, and it was his first visit to Adyar, S. Rinpoche, who has been there since, but giving a seminar at that time. And said two things that were very important. It was with regard to Buddhist meditation, and since then there's a little pamphlet on Buddhist meditation by S. Rinpoche, a very remarkable person, in my estimation. And he mentioned that when you are seeking a teacher, you examine the individual to whom you go as a teacher. That is, you examine very carefully. And he said, it's as though you go into the bazaar and you're looking for some piece of goods, cloth. And you are very careful in the examination of the cloth. You look at it from every point of view. How well woven is it? How does it hold up? Is it what you want? And all of that. You examine it. In the same way, you must examine the teacher. You must really examine, is the teacher one who really can help you to achieve that state that you're seeking? Does he have a greater understanding? Does he have some wisdom, some greater understanding of the subject? Does he share it in a meaningful way that will speak to you so that it is understandable, or is it too far beyond? At the same time, the teacher examines you. Are you in a condition to learn? And the wise teacher is always one who says, I've taken you as far as I can. Now you may need another teacher. But permits you to make your mistakes. Doesn't do your homework for you, in other words. Doesn't say, well, I'll take this on. I'll take your karma over. I remember reading a book, I won't say by whom it was, because that's irrelevant, but in which it said, I as a teacher will take on your karma. Nobody can take on the burden of self-responsibility. So the teacher examines you, you examine the teacher. And the teacher is open to being examined. The teacher is willing to be examined. So that there is an understanding, and there you can have a whole list of characteristics of what you're examining for, to know whether it is a genuine teacher or one that is just pretending to be a teacher, who says, well, you see this certificate, it shows that I have reached the 18th initiation, and therefore I'm in a position to teach you, and if you follow me strictly, you will get to that 18th initiation in this life. And of course, if you pay me sufficiently, then I can opportunity to sit together for a few moments quietly. We've been on a journey. We now go our individual ways, but the contacts, the links that are here, some of us, of course, meeting for the first time, some of us who have met, we've met for many times, many occasions. I want to thank you and, of course, thank the center for being here. Thank Kim Du for inviting me to come to the center again. And to remind you that there are several centers on the physical level through which, through our aspirations, through our dedication, through our commitment to this way of life, through which then these centers can serve as channels, as instruments for the great ones and the work that they are doing to aid humanity. So we're all linked. I live at the center known as Crotona in California. There is the center in Sydney, the Manor. Each center has its own uniqueness, sometimes said to be on a different ray, each of the centers, but I like to think of it as the uniqueness of each center linked through that greater center, the great center at Adyar. And I think if we can keep in mind that all over the world, and particularly through these centers, there are members of the society who are committed to this kind of vision, a vision of humanity in its progress towards freedom, genuine freedom, peace, genuine peace, to understanding and wisdom, uniting all peoples everywhere, permitting differences but never permitting the differences to cause distinctions that result in misunderstandings. And if we could constantly keep in mind that as we make whatever slight progress we may make in understanding this great philosophy, these wonderful truths, that they are meant for our use, the personal use, to use them in our daily lives, to find a way by which we can look, listen, inquire, understand, and that whatever text we turn to, there is the guidance that helps us to live a little bit better. Live tomorrow a little bit better than today. And live in the next hour a little bit better than in the last hour, even. So I thought I just wanted to share that with you. It's always a privilege, so far as I'm concerned, it's a privilege to share ideas that have seemed meaningful to me. I hope they have had some meaning for all of you. But I think we each find the light that shines on our own path. The light is within. Let that light shine. You want to add anything, Kim, do, and then we'll have a little meditation.
Friends and brothers, during a few days, we have benefited from the sharing of Joy. She gave us many of her insights on the subject of light on the path. For that, I think that I can express on behalf of the participants our warmest thanks to you, Joy. And please feel at home here, because our center is a home for all dedicated workers and committed members of the TS. So for that, we are very grateful of your sharing, of your insight in that. And this is all the more helpful for all of us and each one of us, because although we are searching with our drawbacks, our lack of qualities, I think that there is this quality which we can be certain that all of us are sincere in our search. And in this sincerity, there is a movement which is natural inside us. And we are all searching for harmony. And this harmonious center should move towards one direction, which is a more inner center of ourselves. And in that movement, which we can call conversion in the religious meaning of it, we cannot move in the opposite direction. Once the conversion movement is started, it will go on and continue. And for this, I think that we all have participated into this setting up of the atmosphere and the quality of vibrations of our home, this center. So please feel at home and come back anytime
you
would like to come
Thank
back.
You. You all must visit the Crotona Center, the Adyar Center, all the centers.
I'm not going to say more. And please, we can sit together and be with you for a while.
I would like to suggest we take a passage from Light on the Path just to contemplate. As we sit quietly, can we listen? Listen to the song of life. It is not, as many suppose, a cry. It is a song. And listen to that song in your own heart. Then let that song resonate outwards, a song that will bring healing and peace, beauty and joyousness to all who seek. And fare forward till we meet again. Person is the result of the karmic tendencies, which we call the skandhas, all of the tendencies which have gone to coalesce that form so that we are the inheritors of our own karma in form, in personality. The body of the enlightened one is the conscious coming together of those elements that will constitute an appropriate vehicle for that consciousness. This is part of the mystery of the Buddha that HBB speaks about in her esoteric writings, and why it has often been said that therefore, that Gautama had to, the material of that vehicle, which Gautama used, and in which he became the enlightened one, was used by Shankaracharya, which is one of the great mysteries. HBB calls it the mystery of the Buddha. And there's a wonderful article by her on that subject. So that it's the conscious creation, whereas for us, it's the unconscious creation brought about by the karmic tendencies or skandhas.
Therefore, they told us the Buddha didn't die. They didn't find his corpse, he just went. Mm-hmm. That is the same, that is because he consciously took this persona. Mm-hmm. He could also
dissolve it.
Yeah?
Yes, Richard.
I have a question. I think it's related to what you were saying just now. And I'm referring to your remark the other day about the way back or inwards towards unity and the other way going outwards towards multiplicity. I wonder if it's one of the greatest tests for us is to stand, or maybe it's one of the greatest aspects of the path is to stand stable between these two pulls. Because you have, on one hand, the pull of spirit, the pull of potential world, that with the promise of peace and all and dreams, all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there's the pull of matter, mm-hmm. pull of form, say, mm-hmm. and sort of tempt you to lose yourself.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. I wonder if that is part of the test for a human being, mm-hmm. is to stand stable between these two powers, that these two mm-hmm. pools.
I think it is. I think very much so. And HPB makes the statement, and I used it for the basis of my talk in Italy, because she points out that the very essence of theosophy is the harmonization of the divine and the human within us. And she equates in that the human with the animal passions. And it's the equilibrization, it's the harmonization, it's of that. And this is why the human stage is, it is said, the most difficult. The most difficult. Because it is that equilibrium. And indeed, this is what the Bhagavad Gita points to. He who is stable in mind, which means the stability is achieved in consciousness, that individual is the true yogi, according to the Gita. So it's found there, yes. And it's this balance point, which is a very risky business, because it's so easy to fall off one direction or the other, towards the animal passions, the animal soul, or towards just an escapism in which, you know, there's a statement in the Mahatma letters where egos perish by the millions or by the thousands or whatever, because they have not established this center from which they can maintain that equilibrium. So it's... yes, Elizabeth.
In connection with this, I wonder what consciousness is. You told us that all we are talking about is really a process of consciousness these days. And I wonder if you need these two poles to become conscious. So what is consciousness? Is it sometimes it is described as one of the poles? Mm-hmm. One is matter and the other is movement of space and mm-hmm. movement or spirit or consciousness. But I also found an explanation that consciousness is just the movement between the two. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wonder whether that is so.
I think it is. To me, it's that. And I think Annie Besant points to that in her definition of the human being, that it's this equilibrium between the two poles of spirit and matter, united by, as Annie Besant puts it, united by intelligence. And this is why, in the Secret Doctrine, there are three streams of evolution, which, as HVB says, are interblended and interwoven at our stage, but each has its own laws, the monadic, or spiritual, the intellectual, or monastic, and the physico-etheric. And, of course, each is dependent on the other in that sense. But the middle ground, that which is the human stage, where we are finding this equilibrium and finding it so difficult, is where consciousness comes to self-consciousness and then to that consciousness of the one self. So it's always that equilibrium, as Richard said, between the two poles, yes. Not easy to achieve. And indeed, this is what HPB points to as the essence of theosophy, is this harmonization of these two within us. And furthermore, to do it while in physical incarnation in this particular cycle. Because it has to be brought into whatever is the lowest point of the cycle, and it is said that our cycle, this fourth chain, this fourth globe of the planetary chain, which is the densest here is where the real work is the most difficult. But the fact that it was achieved by the Buddha as a sixth rounder, by Plato, Confucius as fifth rounders, indicates that it is possible for us to achieve it. We really don't know what the seventh rounder is going to be like. But because the Mahatmas suggest that one can only move two rounds further, and that's the Buddha, who is called the sixth rounder. We're fourth rounders. And here is where, again, I think the teaching of the secret doctrine is extremely helpful. You can say, well, what difference does it make whether we're fourth round or whatever, and so on. Remember that each of the cycles, called rounds, through the whole chain of globes, each of the rounds gives emphasis to a particular principle. Then within the round, the stages of development, which were called brute races, a most unsatisfactory term today, because it's not ethnic groups or national groups, but stages of development, within is the sub-emphasis, as it were, on that on the principle involved. So from the point of view of our present state, we're in the fourth round where the emphasis is on kama. But we're in the fifth developmental stage where the emphasis is on manas. So it's manas kama. And as someone, one of the students, I don't know whether it was E.L. Gardner or who, but one of the students pointed out that just wait till we're in the fifth round and the fifth stage of the fifth round and the emphasis is manas manas if we think this is difficult. But the emphasis, therefore, is on the manasic aspect of kama, desire, passion. And this is very clear again in the Bhagavad Gita, that to endure while yet on earth, ere be liberated from the body, the passion born from the burden born from passion and desire, this to endure it, which means in consciousness, he is harmonized, says the Gita. He is the happy man. It's a very interesting statement when you analyze it from this point of view. And this, he who can endure, ere he be liberated from the body, the consciousness, it's not consciousness that's used, but the essence born of desire and passion, he is harmonized. He is the happy man. I've forgotten just, I think it's in the fourth chapter of the Gita, but I could be wrong on that. But, it's early on in the Gita. And to analyze it, it's extreme. It says the same thing that HVB says, but puts it in terms of our own life, which is very interesting, because this is the test. Now, the secret doctrine gives the whole picture, but it points to precisely where we are, which is the manasic aspect of kama. And incidentally, this is repeated in the Charter of UNESCO. Since wars begin in the minds of men, it's in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be built. So what is war but the reflection of the passional nature? Begins in manas. And so this is what we are attempting to do, which is going against the general stream of evolution outwards, is trying to now bring about a condition. And I think this, to me, this is why the theosophical philosophy was made public in the last century. That it would be here at this very critical time in human affairs in this century. And that it would have spread all over the world. Incredible. But it has. And I think this is why, for the first time in all history, it was enunciated outside the mystery schools and in the vernacular. true. I grant you it was given in English, but that's the vernacular. A most unphilosophical language. Perhaps the least philosophical language. It's a marvelous language for trade and commerce. Commerce. English has become the language of trade and commerce, but it is not a philosophical language at all. Sanskrit, Greek, Hebrew, these are philosophical languages, really. But why was it given in the vernacular in the last century, made available publicly, which was the great experiment, as we know, by the two Mahatmas who were so eager that this be shared, given outside of the mystery schools, given in a way that did not demand that anybody prepare himself for this, as would be true in the mystery schools of the past, where there were long years of preparation, long years of silence even in the Pythagorean school, for example. You know, why then? Because here is the most crucial, this is, if we can get over this, I always remember Phoebe Bendit saying, somehow I think we'll make it this time. Which always gave me a sense of hope. But Phoebe Bendit, some of you may know her name, Phoebe used to talk about this a good deal. And why was this given then? At this crucial time, which is a turning point in history, as we enter into the third millennium of our particular era, and as we count it, at least, why? Because this is the most crucial, this is one of those stages. Now, there will be further critical stages in the future, in the fifth round when it's manas, manas is going to be extremely critical. At this stage, it's manas aspect of kama. And what we are attempting to do is go against the whole stream by turning kama manas into buddhi manas, which is much further ahead, and this is the enlightenment, which is the sixth round. And consequently, we have the four noble truths, of which there will be five and six, and ultimately seven. Does this make sense? So any guru, then, to me, is false, who is not grounded then in this fundamental commitment that deals with the movement of consciousness to its universal roots, to a universality, the recognition of the one life. At come what may, what the cost doesn't matter. To serve humanity is the first requirement. To live to benefit mankind is the first step. The other question I was asked, and there's just about time, and then let's take a break and come back for just a very brief closing, and Kim Gu may have something to say. Anyway, I don't know. We'll just have a very brief closing and a little meditation together, perhaps. That the last question I was asked, what is the difference between psychic and spiritual powers? I think psychic and spiritual powers. If this is called the path of power. Again, I think it's very, very clear. Psychic powers do not change the individual one little bit. If you are greedy, you are still greedy. You have this psychic vision, you have psychic powers, you can levitate a chair, a table, you can see auras, you know. I remember somebody telling me they saw a master standing behind me, and I said, oh, who is it? The master Kundalini, which I thought was an interesting answer. Anyway, if you can see auras, see colors, What does this show? You may still fall over the rock in the path in front of you physically. The spiritual vision, the spiritual power, is the power to benefit humanity. And the spiritual vision completely changes you, completely. You are never again the same. It shakes you. It's that mystical vision that completely changes your whole perspective. It's the kind of change that Saul experienced on the road to Damascus, which made him Saint Paul. It gives you a new name, in other words. It's the kind of vision that transformed the young Francis of Assisi from this very careless, flippant young man to the great lover of all existence. It's the kind of change that won't let you go. It's the kind of vision that shakes you to the very roots of your being, whereas the psychic power, the psychic vision, leaves you totally, again, immersed in your own personal, selfish, greedy interests, self-concern. I can read your aura. I can tell what you're thinking. I can levitate things. I hear voices. But you're not hearing the voice of the universal self. You're not seeing the divine in every individual. This is the spiritual vision, I think. So there's a clear distinction, a very clear distinction. And the word I, as a center of personal concern, is removed from the vocabulary. I is used to designate the individual who has certain things to do in the world. I have a plane to catch tomorrow. I have this to do. I have that to do, yes, but not in any personal self-concern that I must be sure that I have certain comforts, that I have certain things aggrandized. I have a certain bank account, that I have this and I have that. That's better than yours in that sense. Well, there are many other questions I expect we could take up, but these were the ones that were asked and it gave us an opportunity. Yes.
Can you give me an explanation about truth? For instance, when I see this, it is compact, but when I see it on an electron microscope, you see it as points. Mm-hmm. Just also on astral view and mental view, and so on. At your level.
But does that change to see it at the astral or mental level? Does that change you? Of course, this can be analyzed under the microscope, and one sees it in. What appears to be solid matter is in constant motion, isn't it? Continuous motion. So, what are the facts of existence which may not be the truth at all? What is the truth underlying everything that is there present in the physical universe in any level? What is the reality of which it is an expression? The invention of the microphone is a very useful tool, a very useful tool which enables us to be heard in a sense. But what is the ultimate reality behind it? The whole universe is sound, nothing but sound. Vibration, if you like, but sound. So that there is the reality underlying everything in the physical system, constant sounding. Can we hear that sound of reality? The sound of the self. The Tibetan Book of the Dead mentions it in the bardo state, doesn't it? To hear the sound of the self as a thousand thunders roaring. And can we hear that sound of ultimate reality, which is there, constantly sounding? And are we in harmony with it? Are we moving with it? Well, let's take a 15-minute break, shall we?